From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Girl in the Coffin. One Saturday evening of February 1851, a carriage drove up to the door of a carpenter shop in the neighborhood of the Rue Saint-Honore. A gentleman in a black coat, his hat drawn low over his forehead, entered the shop and inquired for the owner. The owner appeared and asked what service he could render. The gentleman told him that he required a workman who could execute repairs that very evening. The owner of the shop agreed and entrusted the job to a young carpenter. Armed with tools that he was told would be necessary, the young carpenter entered the strange gentleman's carriage and was driven up the Champs-Élysées Avenue. The carriage stopped a little way beyond the Place de l'Étoile, and the gentleman informed the young man that it would be necessary to bandage his eyes, as the job for which he was needed had to be executed in the greatest secrecy. The young man would not consent at first, but eventually agreed and allowed the gentleman to bandage his eyes. The carriage drove on and very shortly stopped again. The young man was lifted out of the carriage by two masked men, who carried him into a building and down a number of stone steps. The bandage was removed from his eyes, and he found himself in a large cellar containing a pile of deal boards. The gentleman told him to make a coffin out of the boards and threatened to shoot him if he refused. After he had made the coffin, he was led into an inner cellar and told that he must stay there until he was wanted. There was a hole in one of the walls of the cellar through which he could see a water butt, and he was straining his eyes in an endeavor to see some other objects that might aid him to identify the building when he was summoned to the outer cellar. There, to his astonishment, he saw a lovely young girl, who was on her knees with her hands clasped in front of her. "You fiends," she exclaimed, "I know that you are going to kill me, but I beg you to spare him." The terrified young carpenter was not sure whether she meant him or someone else. The masked men who had carried him into the building seized the girl, and in spite of her cries for mercy and desperate struggles, they thrust her into the coffin. The young man was too overcome with horror to help her. The gentleman in the cloak pointed a pistol at him and ordered him to nail the coffin down. He tremblingly obeyed. Directly he had accomplished his dreadful task, his eyes were again bandaged, and he was driven to a spot near the Place de l'Étoile. There he was put down with his bag of tools and was warned that if he dared to tell anyone what he had witnessed, he would be killed. He watched the carriage drive away in the direction of the Bois de Boulogne. As soon as it was out of sight, he hastened home. He was so ill that a doctor was summoned. He related his experience to the doctor, whose efforts to save him were of no avail. He died within a few hours. The doctor repeated his story to the police. The employer of the young carpenter told the police about the gentleman in the black cloak and a strange request. The police made exhaustive inquiries. No one corresponding to the young carpenter's description of the girl in the coffin was known to be missing, nor could any clue as to the identity and whereabouts of the gentleman in the black cloak be found. People wondered whether the young carpenter's extraordinary experience was factual, whether it was due to some supernatural agency, or whether the young man was merely the victim of a very harrowing hallucination. The affair was relegated to the category of unsolved mysteries for which Paris is famous. The Grey House of Horror. The following story of a gruesome haunting in France was told me by one of my readers. It was narrated to her by Monsieur Duvon, a retired French merchant, who vouched for the truth of it. There was something ominous in the appearance of the Grey House. Standing in spacious grounds near a major road, it was, like its name, grey, but grey with the greyness of death. People who lived in the neighborhood complained that they always experienced a chilly sensation when they passed by it. Children were much too scared by the look of it and by the stories they had heard about the haunting to linger in close proximity to it, and if a ball thrown carelessly by one of them fell into the grounds of the house, no one ever dared to venture in quest of it. People never occupied the house for long, and more than one mysterious death was rumored to have taken place within its forbidding walls. It was the cheapness of the house that tempted Monsieur Duvorne to buy it, to acquire a commodious house and large grounds freehold, and within about 50 miles of Paris for a quarter the price he had paid for the house in which he was living was wonderful. It was a thousand pities Madame Duvorne was not altogether satisfied. She complained that the grey house would not be easy to run with only 2 servants, a cook and a housemaid. There were so many stairs and so few modern conveniences. Moreover, there was something in the atmosphere of the house that she did not like. She could not very easily describe the something, but it depressed her and imparted a feeling almost of dread. Monsieur Duvorne only laughed and declared that it was just her fancy, that she would get over it when the house had been touched up a bit and made to look a little bit more cheerful. It merely needed new wallpapers and a few roaring fires to make it very cozy. "I like the house," he told her. "There's plenty of space, and that will be a treat after having been cooped up for so long in a small-town villa. The fresh country air would do us all the world of good. There'll be no need to buy fruit or vegetables. We shall be able to grow all we want, and if we have more than we need for ourselves, we can sell it. Fowls, too. We can have new-laid eggs every day." He tried very hard to infect Madame Duvorne and his children with his enthusiasm for the grey house. There were 6 children. Henri, the eldest, was an accountant. Louise, a good-looking brunette, was a typist and stenographer. Pierre, who was just 18 years of age, was a clerk in a solicitor's office. Marie, the second girl, was a manicurist. Henriette and Maxime were still at school. They were all quite ignorant of the ill reputation which the grey house bore in the locality, and the agent, through whose medium Monsieur Duvorne brought the property, refrained very discreetly from alluding to it. The family did not move into the grey house until the papering of the walls and painting of the doors and windows was finished, and everything was in readiness for the newcomers. Monsieur and Madame Duvorne were the first to arrive. The rest of the family were unable to come till later in the day. The behavior of the dogs, Raoul and Muffin, struck Madame Duvorne as odd. They evinced great reluctance to enter the grounds and still greater reluctance to enter the house. Usually, on going to a place that they had not been to before, they would wander around and do a little investigation. But instead of doing this, when they entered the grey house, they kept close to Madame Duvorne and seemed very much afraid. Their behavior puzzled Madame Duvorne, and she wondered if they sensed that something unpleasant in the house and grounds which she sensed. It was not until the dogs had been in the building for some minutes that they appeared to be a little more at ease. Monsieur Duvorne was right when he described the grey house as commodious. It was in the sense of being roomy, for the hall was spacious, the staircase wide, and most of the rooms were large with high ceilings and wide chimneys. But even with the new paint and paper, there was still a curious gloom about the interior of the building. Madame Duvorne felt it. Monsieur Duvorne did not appear to notice it. Except for the dogs being very restless during the day and whining and growling at night, nothing unusual or in any way alarming occurred until the Duvornes had been in the house for several weeks. It was one night, about the middle of September, that Louise awoke to hear the dogs barking and then sounds as if something was being rolled or pushed across the floor of the landing over her head. Wondering what it could be, she sat up in bed and listened. Presently there was a queer bumping sound, followed by another, and then another, as if some heavy object like a barrel was coming down the stairs. She got up, switched on the light, and opened the door. The staircase was at the far end of the landing, but the moonlight pouring through a window above it enabled her to see it tolerably clearly. The bumping reached the landing on which she stood, continued across it, and went on down the wide staircase into the hall. A few moments later there was a loud crash, as if a quantity of crockery had fallen or been thrown from a height onto the stone floor. After that there was a deep and prolonged silence. Up to now Louise had been more curious than actually scared. She had seen nothing, but there was something so eerie and frightening in the silence that she sprang back to her room, locked the door, and scrambled into bed. She kept the light on until the dawn had broken. At breakfast, she inquired if anyone had heard anything in the night. Henriette said she had heard queer noises. Henriette's and hers account of the alarming sounds were received with skepticism by all the family, with the exception of Madame Duvorne, who appeared to be greatly concerned. 2 days later, the cook and housemaid complained that there was something wrong with the drains. They said that on their way to bed the previous night, they had nearly suffocated by a vile stink. It was on the back staircase leading from the basement to their quarters in the rear of the house. Monsieur Duvorne was puzzled and skeptical. He told them that he could not understand how the drains could be at fault, as before buying the house, he had them thoroughly tested, and they had been found to be in a very satisfactory condition. What the maid said, however, was very shortly confirmed by an experience that befell Henri. He was resting his elbows on the windowsill of his bedroom early one evening, gazing at the moonlit lawn and the white, glimmering road in the distance, when he fell into a reverie, from which he was abruptly aroused and brought sharply back to earth by the barking and growling of the dogs, and a sensation of great coldness, which turned into one of loathing, when his nostrils were assailed by an overpowering stench. It was so dreadful that he quickly threw open the window and, in order to rid himself of the stink, inhaled deep breaths of the cool night air. Hearing a strange noise behind him, he turned round and saw a tall object move across the floor and disappear by the door. It was too vague and shadowy for him to discern at all distinctly, but he got the impression of something unpleasantly bizarre, and was so terrified that he fled downstairs to the drawing room, where the rest of the family were gathered. Into their astonished ears, as soon as he had recovered breath, he poured a somewhat confused account of what had happened. Monsieur Duvorne attributed it to his imagination, but at the same time showed symptoms of uneasiness. The next day something occurred to augment that uneasiness, in no small measure. He was sitting by the dining-room fire reading when a cold current of air made him shiver. Glancing round to see whence it proceeded, he saw the door was wide open. Thinking it odd because he remembered shutting it, but supposing that he had not latched it properly, or that someone had opened it without his hearing him or her, he closed it carefully and resumed his reading. He had, however, only been occupied thus for a few minutes, when he again felt a cold blast of air sweep past him, and turning he perceived that the door was again wide open. He rose and was about to go to the door to close it when he was aware of a foul smell. It seemed to come from the doorway, and although he could see nothing to account for it, he had the distinct feeling that something had entered the room and was standing looking at him. He got the impression of a body in the last stages of putrefaction. Unable to stand the smell, he fled to the French window, tore it open, and made an undignified, precipitate exit into the garden. He was very badly scared, but not wanting to prejudice the family still more against the house, he kept the incident to himself. It was in the garden that the next happening of a disturbing nature occurred. Marie and Henriette were strolling about the lawn one fine Sunday afternoon, when the twilight was gradually deepening and a half-moon was gleaming faintly in the darkening autumn sky. Feeling someone was behind them, Marie looked hastily round, but saw nothing. They went on, and still fancied that someone was following them. The feeling was so acute that they were obliged to keep looking round, and each time the result was the same. No one was visible. They came to a junction of several paths. Close to it was an old covered-in well, which had not been used for very many years. They paused to look at it, for it had a strange fascination for them. While they were gazing at it, something that they could not see rushed past them. A moment or two afterwards, they heard a splash, as if something very heavy had fallen into the well. They were so frightened that they ran back to the house, and all the way to it heard footsteps bounding along after them. That night, Marie woke and saw shadowy funeral pall descend from the ceiling onto the bed in which Henriette was sleeping. It assumed the outlines of a coffin. She sat up in terror. The pall vanished. Her scream roused Henriette, who asked if anything had happened. Marie pretended that she had had a bad dream. Neither of the girls went to sleep again. They lay awake talking until the morning. A week after this incident, the cook and the housemaid gave notice to leave. They said that they could not sleep a night because of the alarming noises, and that they had had more than enough of the abominable smells. Madame Duvorne could not get any maid to sleep in the house, and had difficulty in obtaining two daily women, who could not be persuaded to stay after it began to get dusk. As a result, Madame Duvorne, assisted by one of the girls, had to get the dinner. Monsieur Duvorne still professed to be in love with the house, but there were signs of increasing discontent among the other members of the family. One day, When the girls and Maxime were in one of the side gardens, there was a curious noise seemingly behind a bush that grew close to a wall. Both dogs growled, and their hair bristled. "Go seek Raoul," Maxime cried. "Go on, fetch him out. See who's there." Thus urged, Raoul, with obvious reluctance, pushed his way into the bush, disappeared for a few seconds, and then rushed out with his tail drooping, looking very badly scared. Maxime went behind the bush and searched it well, but could not discover anything to account for the dog's behavior. The next day, Raoul would not touch his food or leave his kennel. He stayed there all curled up and so obviously ill that Monsieur Duvorne had a vet to see him. The vet frankly admitted that he did not quite know what was the matter with Raoul. He thought that may have had a bad fright. He gave him some medicine, but it did not do Raoul any good, and he died a day or two after. Everyone in the house was upset, for the Duvornes were great animal lovers, and they were all very fond of Raoul. Maxime was certain that something in the bush, some hidden horror, was responsible for Raoul's death. A rough-haired fox terrier puppy was brought to keep Muffin company. For more than a week, the Duvornes enjoyed a respite from the smells, but much anxiety was caused by the indisposition of Henriette. The local doctor, who was called in at first, attributed it to indigestion, then to gastric trouble, after that to Magrime, and finally to a combination of all three. His remedies were of no avail. Madame Duvorne was sure that it was the atmosphere of the house which was bad for them all, and begged her husband to sell or let the place. This he would not do. Henriette's illness had nothing to do with the house, he said. She would probably have been ill in Nantes, where we used to live. She's been working too hard. They gave her too many lessons at school. She needs a good long holiday and plenty of fresh air. That will do her more good than any physique. We have given this house a proper trial yet. Wait another 6 months, and if anything unpleasant occurs during that time, a repetition of those stinks, for instance, I will do as you suggest and quit, though we shall never find another so suitable a place. Suitable in every way. Room, space, garden, situation. Everything that we want. Madame Duvorne sighed. She realized the hopelessness of arguing with him. Never was there such a pig-headed, mulish man. A most potent influence than any argument was, however, impending. Monsieur Duvorne was very much a person of habit and routine. He awoke and got up always about the same time every day, and as regularly had his meals and went for a constitutional. If the weather was fine, he spent a certain restricted time in the garden. If wet, he stayed indoors and read for the improvement of his mind, he told the family. The finding of some of his literature carefully hidden away created considerable amusement and some cynicism in the readers. His bedroom was somewhat isolated. It was the only room in a short passage or corridor leading out of the first landing. He liked it because the dormer windows commanded an extensive view of one of the lawns and the country beyond. It had a wide old-fashioned chimney and a large cupboard deep set in the wall. There was a gloom even on a bright sunny day, but that Monsieur Duvorne professed not to mind. Not feeling too well one night during the last week of November, he went to bed a trifle earlier than usual, and the weather being stormy and bitterly cold, he had a coal fire in his room. The elements increased in violence as the night advanced. The wind howled and whistled down the chimney and beat the snow and ivy leaves against the windows with a fury that threatened to break the glass. Monsieur Duvorne lost no time in undressing and getting into bed. For a long time he lay listening to the wind and the flaking sound of ashes as they fell onto the hearth, and watching the grotesque shadows cast on the ceiling by the flickering fire flames. Drowsiness at last stealing over him, he relapsed into a deep, dreamless sleep. He woke with a wild shriek of the wind ringing in his ears and was conscious of a vile, nauseating smell. Raising himself up in bed and opening his eyes, he received a terrible shock. Standing at the foot of the bed, its horrible head thrust aggressively forward, was a tall, nude, luminous figure. Its face was that of a corpse in an advanced state of decomposition. The livid, scaly flesh seemed to be falling from the bones. The rotting lips were wreathed in a leer that revealed long, jagged, yellow teeth. Only the pale, slanting eyes were alive. They were fixed on Monsieur Duvorne with an expression of malicious glee. A gruesome, leadenish blue light enveloped the whole body. The shock Monsieur Duvorne experienced on beholding such an appalling spectacle was so great that he fainted, and it was not for some time after he had recovered consciousness that he ventured to open his eyes. The figure had vanished. The fire was out, and the room was in darkness. Daylight seemed an age in coming. Seldom had Monsieur Duvorne been so thankful as he was when a rap on the door announced the arrival of his early cup of coffee. He did not tell the family what he had seen. They guessed from his face that he had none too good a night, and their suspicions increased when he told them that he had come round to their way of thinking and considered it wisest, after all, to vacate the house. Fortunately for the Duvornes, the scramble for houses surrendered it easy to sell the grey house, and they were lucky enough to find new quarters almost at once. The move into other surroundings put new life into Henriette, whose mysterious malady took a turn for the better directly she left the grey house. Curious to learn something about the history of the grey house, Pierre made numerous inquiries and learned eventually that on its site there had once been a very ancient mansion. Horrible deeds were alleged to have taken place within its grim and sinister walls, and for that reason not only the building itself, but the ground on which it stood was accursed. Misfortune overtook all who occupied it. The de Morvels, into whose hands the estate passed in the 17th century, met with nothing but trouble and disaster all the time they owned it. They sold it to the Lantiers. During the Lantiers' occupation of the house, a mysterious fire occurred one night, and only the bare blackened walls were left standing. The Goudets, who bought the estate from the Lantiers, had the ruin of the old mansion cleared away, and a new house was erected on its site. The life of the new house was short. It was leveled to the ground during the French Revolution. Its inmates, the dead and living, were thrown into a well by the enemies of the aristocrats. A few years after the Revolution, the grey house was built. At first it was a private residence, and then it became an inn, which acquired a very evil reputation. After the death of the landlord, the grey house once again became a private residence. Those who owned it always appeared to be only too glad to get rid of it. If what Pierre Duvorne learned about the history of the grey house and about that of its predecessors was true, one can hardly be surprised that the place was haunted. Accursed places exude baleful influence and act as magnets to all kinds of evil spirits. The Man in Flannels. The following story was told me when I was staying in Montparnasse shortly before the 1914 war. Near the ancient city of B in Western Europe, there is a bridge over a precipitous gorge. The bridge would seem to have a peculiar attraction for suicides, some of whom travel many miles to take the fatal plunge. Except at Easter and during the summer months, the traffic over the bridge is not very great. The scenery on either side is very beautiful. The heights are thickly clothed with a great variety of trees, some of whose lateral branches protrude far over the edge of the cliffs. At the foot of the rocks, and occupying nearly all the intervening space, flows a deep, swift-flowing river, which at times becomes a roaring torrent. One feels, when standing on the bridge and gazing into the somber depths, a horrible fascination for the river. The dark, horrid, swerving, shrieking water seems to rise slowly up, and with its cold, baleful breath to suck one into its seething bosom. The desire to fall, to plunge down, 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 into the rushing, foaming torrent, surges through one's mind. The lot of the tollmen who are on duty at night is by no means enviable. At the end of the last century, one of the tollmen was a tall, thin, red-haired, lantern-jawed individual named Leif Cross. He was a strong Sabbatarian and regarded any type of recreation on a Sunday as a sin. One early autumn Sunday evening, he was so overcome at the sight of a man actually in white flannel trousers and carrying a lawn tennis racket on Sunday that he forgot to ask him to pay the usual toll money until he had reached the middle of the bridge. "Hi, you!" he then shouted indignantly. "Come back! You've not paid the toll money!" The stranger stopped, turned slowly around so that Cross could see every line and feature in his face, and then without saying a word he climbed over the railing at the side of the bridge and dropped into the river. Too horror-stricken to move or utter a sound, Cross saw him go right down, turning over and over, his white face and clothes standing out in ghastly contrast to the dark background, till he struck the black swirling inferno, when he was instantly whirled out of sight. It was not until he had been swept away by the rushing water that Cross fully realized what had happened. "My God," he said, and I might have stopped him. It was his clothes and the racket. That's what happens when people won't keep the Sabbath. He at once reported the tragedy to the police. A search was made for the suicide's body, but with no result. His identity was never known. The following Sunday evening, Cross was on duty as usual in the toll house. The weather was cold and raw. A heavy mist hung over the gorge. There had been but little traffic all day, and after nightfall the bridge and the adjoining roads were absolutely deserted. Minute after minute passed, and Cross could hear nothing but the creaking and groaning of iron girders and the distant thunder of rushing water, the echoes of which sounded and resounded through the whole length of the frightful chasm and out into the ponderous stillness of the foggy night air. There had been a time when Cross, who was very unimaginative and always well fortified with the scriptures, had not minded the loneliness of his nocturnal vigils. Seated in his cozy little room, a blazing fire in front of him and a jug of hot coffee on the hob, he had laughed at the wind and rain and all the uncanny sounds accompanying them in the gorge. But now, with a vision of the ghastly white-faced falling suicide still vivid in his memory, the darkness and loneliness of the night scared him. He found himself continually listening, why and for what he did not know. Once he fancied he heard footsteps hurriedly approaching the bridge. He sprang from his seat, opened the little window at which he took his payments, apprehensively searched the gloom with his eyes, and listened. He had been fooled. What he had heard were not footsteps, only the flapping of some loose timber. He returned to the fire, trembling. Presently he heard a queer sound. He was on his feet again, his ears strained. Badly frightened, he opened the window and peered into the surrounding darkness. From the gorge rose a cry, shrill, agonizing, awful, as of someone in deadly fear or pain. It seemed to quiver for a moment in the air, and then went sobbing and wailing down the mist-ridden gorge. It was an unearthly sound that chilled the blood in Crass's veins. He was closing the window when something whirled past him. He shrank away from the window, startled. The thing whirled by again, and he forced a laugh. It was only a bird. He sank into his chair, shaking. By and by he fell asleep and awoke with a violent start. A faint glow of light dissipated the darkness outside the house and threw into relief patches of masonry, imparting to them a ghostly whiteness. Cross was at first frightened, then he laughed. The whiteness was due to the dawn, nothing supernatural. The air felt icy, colder than he ever remembered it in the early autumn. He shivered and drew his coat tightly round him. Footsteps. In a moment, all his faculties were keenly alert. Who could it be at 2 o'clock in the morning? His nerves were anyhow. He looked out of the window, fearful of what he might see. Advancing towards him in the pale light of the dawn was a man in white flannels, carrying a lawn tennis racket in one hand. When he drew nearer to the bridge, Crass recognized him. He was the suicide, the man Crass had seen falling from the bridge. He walked past the toll house just as he had done the night of the tragedy. When he reached the middle of the bridge, he turned and looked menacingly at Crass. He then climbed over the railing, looked again at Crass, grinned, and dropped into the yawning chasm. Crass saw him turn head over heels as he fell down and down into the foaming, roaring river. It was not until he disappeared that Crass fully realized he was a phantasm, and that what he had just taken place was a ghostly reenaction of the tragedy which had occurred on the previous Sunday. Cross did not tell anyone except his wife and daughter about the ghost, but he asked the local authorities to let him be on duty during the day instead of at night. To this they reluctantly consented, and the following Sunday about noon found Cross seated in his favorite chair in the toll house. He behaved so queerly, however, continually accusing people of wanting to throw themselves over the bridge, that he was dismissed from his post. A few days later, a laborer and his wife were crossing the bridge on their way home when they heard someone running after them. It was Cross. "He's after me! He's after me!" Cross cried. "For mercy's sake, stop him!" "Stop him? Stop whom?" the laborer exclaimed. "That man in flannels," Cross said. "He gives me no peace. Don't let him catch me. Keep him off!" And with a fearful scream, he climbed over the railing and dropped into the river. After his suicide, the authorities found it very difficult to get men to do night duty in the toll house. No one remained in them for more than a few nights. They all declared that the bridge was haunted, not by one dreadful apparition, but by several. the toll houses were finally abolished, but not the specters, for up to the time I heard this strange story, rumors of ghostly happenings on the bridge were in constant circulation.